We had a bit of a discussion about what readings we were going to do this morning. And since we figure that you all know Genesis 1, I'm only going to read a little bit of that. And we're going to read Psalm 65 as well. So, and by the way, the bit I learned this morning or this week for Te Wiki Aumari is the introduction to the gospel. So you can see how I do. Genesis 1, verses 2 and 3. Well, I did verse 1 as well, because it didn't seem right. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now the earth was formless and empty. Darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. And God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. Whakarongo ki te kupu. Ate wairioa ki te hahi. Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church. Thanks be to God. Kia mo tonu tana, kupu kia tato. Psalm 65. Whoops, just pressed the wrong button on my screen. Praise awaits you, our God, in Zion. To you our vows will be fulfilled. You who answer prayer, to you all people will come. When we are overwhelmed by sins, you forgave our transgressions. Blessed are those you choose and bring near to live in your courts. We are filled with the good things of your house, of your holy temple. You answer us with awesome and righteous deeds, God our Savior, the hope of all the ends of the earth and of the farthest seas, who formed the mountains by your power, having armed yourself with strength, who stilled the roaring of the seas, the roaring of their waves, and the turmoil of the nations. The whole earth is filled with awe at your wonders. Where morning dawns, where evening fades, you call forth songs of joy. You care for the land and water it. You enrich it abundantly. The streams of God are filled with water to provide the people with grain, for so you have ordained it. You drench its furrows and level its ridges. You soften it with showers and bless its crops. You crown the year with your bounty, and your carts overflow with abundance. The grasslands of the wilderness overflow. The hills are clothed with gladness. The meadows are covered with flocks, and the valleys are mantled with grain. They shout for joy and sing. And the Gospel. Te rongopai tapu ki te retinga a hoana te tahi upoko ki timata tahi. The Holy Gospel. Te whakamomati, te karorea, ki te atua. That's the Holy Gospel according to John, chapter 1, verses 1 to 18. The Word became flesh. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Through him all things were made. Without him, nothing was made that has been made. In him was life, and that life was the light of all mankind. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. There was a man sent from God whose name was John. He came as a witness to testify concerning that light, so that through him all might believe. He himself was not the light, he only came as witness to the light. The true light that gives light to everyone was coming into the world. He was in the world, and through him the world was made. And though the world was made through him, the world did not recognize him. He came to that which was his own, but his own did not receive him. Yet to all who did receive him, To those who believed in his name, he gave the right to become the children of God. Children born not of natural descent, nor of human decision or a husband's will, but born of God. The Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. John testified concerning him. He cried out, saying, "This is the one I spoke about when I said, 'He who comes after me has surpassed me because he was before me.' Out of his fullness, we all have received grace in the place of grace already given. For the law was given through Moses. Grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. No one has ever seen God, but the one and only Son, who is himself God and is in the closest relationship with the Father, has made him known. This is the gospel of Christ. Te rongopai tēne a te karāti. Christ the Word. Whakamome I titi ia te kupu mana."
Tēnā koutou katoa, that's working. Yep, awesome. Hey, good morning. It's so lovely to be back here. I feel like I haven't been here for a while. Partly that's because my family, right at the death, finally succumbed to COVID. So I will try not to have a coughing fit this morning. Some of you will know what that's like, the sort of the lingering realities. It's so good to be here on the first of 3 weeks on the season of creation. The season of creation in the church calendar takes place during September and then through to the Feast of St. Francis, which is at the beginning of October. And so this morning what I want to do is reflect on these three really beautiful passages. Penny, thank you for reading them out to us. And some of the themes that we've already touched on this morning, particularly the idea of wonder and joy and celebration and praise. And so, Stu, thank you, Stu. I don't have a clicker here, so my clicker's going to be doing this. So the Genesis 1 passage was sort of, we just gave you the snapshot there, because I'm presuming most of you sort of could almost recount that Genesis 1 creation account off by heart, probably. And so you just got the first couple of verses there. The Genesis account is this amazing biblical account here written by the people of Israel, surrounded in ancient Near East. And it's written by a tradition of priests who are trying to give an account of how does the world come into being, but also how does this story then shape us as the people of God, as Israel. The first thing here to note here is the fact that Genesis 1 is written by a priestly tradition. These are people who are priests who are later in the life of Israel are living their lives of faith around the temple. There's a really interesting pattern that you might want to think about, that takes place here of what I want to suggest is a form and filling pattern, And that what you have taking place in Genesis, it's a temple being built. There's a structure within this beautiful piece of literature that's written. And that is that the world is formed, or there is the literature here creates a form or a space, and then that is filled and populated. And so you have this sort of structure within the text where days 1, 2, and 3, it creates sort of rooms or parameters. So on day 1, darkness is brought under control, and light and darkness is created. Day 2, the deep is brought under control, the chaos of the waters, which for Israel, who is a land-based people, the seas were places of chaos and fear. And here God brings the deep under control, but not only does he bring them under control, but then on day 5, which is the parallel day, he populates them with sea creatures and birds. Likewise, on day 3 here, you have a separation of the waters from land. So land and sea get separated, and then vegetation comes. And so you'll see the parallel here, that on day 1 something happens, and then that space is created, is filled with the sun and moon. Day 2, the waters are brought under control, filled with sea creatures and birds. Day 3, likewise, you say the same thing. And then we turn up on day 6, humanity. Click. No, I'll come back. But so going back to that, therefore this imagery, what I want you to think about this idea of that we live in a cosmic temple. We live in a cosmic temple. This galaxy that we've talked about, which is a place of wonder, has been brought into being by God through the Word. Light has been separated from darkness, and then the space is created with reality, with planets, with solar systems, with stars, with a planet called Earth, with us. This place is then filled. Places of the temple are then populated. You might want to think about what it's like when you buy a house and you walk in for the first time or move into a house and it's an empty shell, but it's as you put things around and as you populate it that life comes to be in that place. And so likewise, the world that we live in, creation has this form, but it also is filled with life because of God's goodness and creation's goodness. Another thing about the part of this passage here is the repetition that takes place when I'm teaching my students. I help them to notice here that repetition, and anybody who does literature will know, oh, if there's repetition, then that means the writer of that text is trying to get something through to you. And so seven times, you might want to think about this seven times, what's the holy number in the Bible? Seven. Seven times we are told that it is good. On the seventh time, we are told that it is very good. Steve asked me just at the beginning, he said, what's your one sentence here that summarizes what are you going to say? What's the take home? The take home is matter matters to God. Matter matters to God. Creation is good. And we're told this seven times in this passage. Another part we're therefore told is to be fruitful and to multiply. And that imagery of the fecundity of creation, the fact that it blossoms and grows. Beautiful imagery this morning from Evie Joy. Like that delight and wonder and joy at seeing something beginning to grow in a little pot. A fourth point, though, here that's important for us to recognise, therefore. And this is, it's amazing how often we still, or I still hear this, we seem to think sometimes that the climax of creation is our arrival. No, that's not how that passage works. The climax of creation actually is right at the end, which is on which day? The seventh day, when the temple has been finished. We just turn up on day six. In fact, we share that day with a whole lot of other land creatures. We seem to think that this is all about us, that the rest of creation is sort of built there as sort of as a backdrop, if you think about a stage production, that's all built there as a backdrop so that we can go, yeah, it's us, it's all about us, we've arrived. No, it's a temple. We're in the temple with everybody else. The day of perfection, the day of climax, is when the temple is opened and others are then welcome to come and be in that temple and to see everybody who is assembled. And of course, why are they assembled in the temple? What do we do in temples? What do we do in sanctuaries? We worship. We give praise. Click. Thanks, Stu. Next, click. What does this therefore tell us about God, creation, and ourselves? Just three quick points here. In Christian doctrine and Christian teaching, God is other than creation. In Orthodox Christian belief, we don't believe that God is crushed into creation or is the same as creation. We say that creation is other than God. There is otherness. And it's that space that allows freedom, but also therefore allows for love. Because if you're in a marriage, but you're actually crushed into each other, then actually there's no space to allow each other to grow and develop. And so it's the very otherness of God from creation, which allows creation to bloom and grow into who it's called to be by God, but therefore gives the space for a relationship between all of creation and God. That doesn't mean, though, therefore, that God is completely separate from creation. It means that I want to suggest that, therefore, creation is suffused with the grace of God. And again, some of those beautiful songs that Bruce has picked this morning, the idea that the glory of God is present in creation, but that God is also transcendent and larger than creation. A second point here, thanks, Stu. What takes place in a temple? We worship. That's what creation is here for. It gives worship and praise and glory to its creator. Psalm 65 that we've just read, this amazing psalm, and in fact the whole of the psalms are full of this imagery of creation giving its praise to God. And often when we read that, we think, oh, this is just metaphorical, the trees of the fields clapping their hands. But if you stand in a forest with the wind blowing and watch trees move, what are the trees doing? They're clapping their hands. When a river is flowing at full stream, what is the river doing? It's giving its glory to God. Perhaps one of the most beautiful ways I think of illustrating this idea of the cosmic temple and then giving worship to God is an extract from C.S. Lewis's Magician's Nephew. Many of you will, I'm almost sure most of you will have read C.S. Lewis's or part of his Narnia. And Before the Lion and the Witch Wardrobe is the first book in the series, which was actually written later, called The Magician's Nephew. And C.S. Lewis gives this sort of this descriptive account of the world coming into being. I'm going to read this to you, and I encourage you here to close your eyes and think about the way in which C.S. Lewis captures this idea of worship. He writes, "In the darkness, something was happening at last. A voice had begun to sing. It was very far away, and Diggory found it hard to decide from what direction it was coming. Sometimes it seemed to come from all directions at once. Sometimes he almost thought it was coming out of the earth beneath them. Its lower notes were deep, deep enough to be the voice of the earth herself. There were no words, there was hardly even a tune, but it was beyond comparison the most beautiful noise he had ever heard. It was so beautiful he could hardly bear it. Then two wonders happened at the same moment. One was that the voice was suddenly joined by other voices, more voices than you could possibly count. They were in harmony with it, but far higher up the scale, cold, tingling, silvery voices. The second wonder was that the blackness overhead, all at once, was blazing with stars. They didn't come out gently one by one, as they do on a summer evening. One moment there had been nothing but darkness. Next moment, 1,000,000 points of light leaped out, single stars, constellations and planets brighter and bigger than any in our world. There were no clouds, and the new stars and the new voices began at exactly the same time. If you had seen it and heard it, as Diggory did, you would have felt quite certain that it was the stars themselves which were singing, and that it was the first voice, the deep one, which had made them appear and made them sing." The passage here from C.S. Lewis goes on in this beautiful imagery here, and the voice, of course, is the voice of Aslan, the lion, who is actually the one who is singing and bringing this world into being, the world of Narnia. Third point here, who are we, therefore, in this temple? Two points here. We are creatures. We turn up on day six. We are creatures. Maybe the best conception of sin is to think that actually we've forgotten our creaturehood. First and foremost, we are creatures. What is our fundamental calling, therefore, as humans? We are homo faber, that is, we have this tremendous capacity as humans because of our intelligence and our dexterity, etc., etc., to create, or as Tolkien would say, C.S. Lewis's compatriot, to co-create, to take the wonder of the world and to do more things with it, because we have this capacity to make things and to be technological and to be creative and imaginative. But I want to suggest that first and foremost, our calling is as homo adorans, that is, worshippers, to give glory, to adore the one who has created us. How might we picture that? I want to suggest, therefore, that we might want to think of ourselves first and foremost as choristers in a temple, in a choir, with a cosmic choir, with the stars, with the moons, with the trees, with the rivers, bringing our praise back to the Creator. It's arguable what, therefore, our role is. Some people would want to say, well, actually, yeah, but we are distinctive and we are different, so maybe our role is that we're the conductor. And we get to stand there and we get everybody else to pray. And you could suggest that. Or maybe it's just that we have a different voice within that choir. And we'll talk a little bit in a moment about the world that we live in and what happens when you begin to kill off voices within that choir. So, what might this amazing story, this ancient story that has been passed on from generation to generation within the Judeo and then Christian tradition mean to us? Some take-homes here for us today, this week, and in the season of creation. Thanks, Stu. Oh, sorry, too early. First, some take-homes. The first thing is that creation is good. Matter matters to God. The passage here from John, the Word became flesh. The Word that brought creation into being then comes in flesh and human form, takes matter into the Godhead. The image there in John 1:14 is that God came in flesh and then made his dwelling with us. And the word dwelling there is the word tabernacle, which is the same imagery that's used when Israel is in the desert. And so this idea here is that in the incarnation, and in Jesus coming in human form, that he comes in human form, but he lives tent-like. What happens with the temple in Israel, with the tabernacle in Israel? Where is the glory of God? In the tabernacle, the people will go to that tent of meeting to encounter the glory of God. And so this John passage is that Jesus has come in flesh, but therefore the glory of God is fully revealed here in the human person of Jesus. What this means for us is that if we have sort of an anti-material spirituality, one that tells us that the flesh is bad or that matter is bad, then I want to suggest that that's a sub-Christian form of spirituality. Because actually Christian spirituality wants to affirm the wonder and the beauty of the physical world in which we live. I was in Auckland yesterday, and at the recommendation of a Reverend Vicar Mark Harris, I went to the Icon exhibition. There was an Icon exhibition at Auckland Art Gallery. Icons are created by the Orthodox stream of the church, and there's a great emphasis here on creation and things that are made that are beautiful. And so an icon is an image, and it's not that you're worshipping the image, you're worshipping the image acts, or the icon acts as a doorway or a window into another reality. And so it's very important for people in the Orthodox tradition. They go up to it and they touch it and they kiss it. And in doing so, they want to honour that, but also honour the reality, this cosmic reality that they're caught up in. And so for those who come from that tradition or from a high church tradition, they'll be used to this idea of touch and smell when you walk into a temple and there is incense and there are smells. Sometimes if we don't live in that tradition or haven't been exposed to that tradition, we think that sort of our spirituality has to somehow just be purely head or conceptual. But I want to suggest that our spirituality involves all our senses, because that's who we are as material beings. Finally, therefore, some reflections about the time that we live in, though, in terms of linking this to the world that we live in now. Our present times, as you will know, because I suspect most of you read the newspapers and watch television and that, we live, some suggest, in a moment of ecological crises. Not a crisis, but crises, because there are multiple crises going on. Climate change is the most obvious of that, but there's also fresh water decline, there's pollution, there's habitat destruction. And one that I want to focus on here is the idea of biodiversity loss. That is the loss of creatures. Scientists tell us that we now are on the threshold of what's known as a sixth great mass extinction. During the world's history, there have been five previous mass extinction events when something cataclysmic has taken place in the world, which has led to an extinction of a large number of species. The fifth one was caused by an asteroid hitting a peninsula, the Yucatan Peninsula in New Mexico, and that led to the decimation of dinosaurs, or the end of dinosaurs, and therefore the creation of the abundance, the coming to life of mammals and therefore us. And what scientists are telling us is that we now live on the edge of a sixth greater mass extinction. That is that the background rate of extinctions amongst species is now running at somewhere between 1,000 and 10,000 times higher than the normal background rate of extinctions. The difference here is that this is not caused by an external event, such as an asteroid. This is being caused because of our pumping gases into the atmosphere. Again, this is not something that we knew was going to happen, but we now live with the consequences of a way of life that we've chosen for the last 250 years. How we respond to that is a big, much bigger political question. But one of the things I want us to think about, therefore, is if this is a cosmic temple, as we lose species, what we're actually losing is members of our choir. Our choir is diminishing. That voice of praise to its creator is slowly being diminished one at a time, one at a time, one at a time. And in doing so, therefore, the praise and glory that is given diminishes as well. What should therefore our posture be as we live in these times? Some reflections here. One approach, or there's two approaches I want to suggest. One is activism. Let's get involved in some sort of activism that will save the world. And I've been involved in that world for 20 years, and there's lots of it, and there's a lots of sort of activism and advocacy, and we've got to do this to save the world from climate change. And I totally think, yes, we need to respond. But I'm also aware that as a base level of spirituality, this sort of messianic, let's save the world, is very, very, very unsustainable long term. Because there's only so long you can keep this sort of energetic activism going. At the other extreme, I look at society and the church and across the board. And the other approach is sort of this lethargic despair or denial, which is, well, actually, there's nothing I can do about it, so I'll just sit on the chuff and do nada. In fact, get depressed. I want to suggest that this imagery of the temple and of worship helps find a space between those two realities of sort of this endless activism and a lethargic despair, do nothing. And I want to suggest that actually our first response as the people of God is one of worship and wonder. How might this be expressed? Thinking here again about this temple imagery, how many of you have visited cathedrals overseas? Probably, I forget a good number. What do you do when you walk into a cathedral? What's the posture when you walk into a cathedral? You look up. What, are you loud? Are you energetic? No, you're silent. You bring yourself down. There's a sense in which you're entering into something sacred, and so therefore you want to be attentive to what's taking place there. Simone Veil is a Christian mystic in the 20th century. She said, attention taken to its highest degree is the same thing as prayer. It presupposes faith and love. Absolutely unmixed attention is prayer. And I want to suggest that maybe our best posture for the world that we live in, therefore, is a stilling of our lives, a slowing down of our lives, a greater attentiveness to the world in which we live. This is not to deny, therefore, that activism and energy and response won't happen. It will happen, but true activism comes out of a posture of contemplation. Two, therefore, reflections here. By the way, this is my daughter. She'll tell me off later on for using this. This is my daughter, Kristen, at the age of, I think about 7 or 8, in a forest, just captured and enamoured, and I just happened to be carrying a camera like I normally do, and I still think it's the most beautiful shot I think I have of my middle daughter, who's just enamoured by the forest that she's in, looking up in a posture of... And bearing in mind, those who know Kristen, she runs at about 1,000,000 miles an hour and is very hard to keep up with. But there was something about that day where she just stopped and paused and was in wonder and awe about that place that she was in. Thanks, Stu. Two things I want to say, therefore, about how this might work out. One is a sort of a shout-out to those who who live in the world of science and who engage in the world of science. A quote here, "All the phenomena of the earth, it seems, have wisdom within them. Wisdom is not only something that humans acquire by observing nature, it also seems to be something that is embedded in nature that humans are challenged to discover." And so in the same way that we walk into a cathedral and we go with a sense of curiosity and inquiry to work out what is it that's going on in this cathedral, what is the life that has lived here, who has lived here, and what is the sort of the legacy they have left in that cathedral. Likewise, scientists who undertake that task in the world to walk around in this cosmic temple and to understand what is this life that has been lived here. And I really want to affirm those who live and work in that tradition because it's a critical part of Christian discipleship. But also though, a posture though of stillness. If through the Son creation has come to be, and if in him all things consist, it must follow that he who contemplates creation rightly is contemplating also the Word who framed it, and through him, therefore, begins to apprehend the Father. So says Athanasius in the 4th century. I want to encourage us, therefore, as homo adorans, as worshippers of God, in this season creation, to take the opportunity to still ourselves. As COVID restrictions lift, there is this, I suspect, a temptation to go, woohoo, let's get back into normal life and get into it. But actually, we've just ended that period. Maybe there's a period here before we transition back into the fullness and craziness of life, of just being still again in this time of the season of creation to remind ourselves again of our connectedness with other creatures and therefore to be filled again with compassion. May this be true for us now, but also into the future as a community. Amen.